21. Finally, the time of the feast arrived. As the guest of honor, Martin turned up last. As he entered, he quickly counted around 20 people in attendance. As they walked to the banquet table, Philip told Martin that almost every wizard in Western Europe was there. But it did not look like a lot of people. Part of the problem was that the party was being held in the great hall of the Castle Camelot, only one of the numerous rectangular slabs that he knew could rise to be used as banquet tables had been lifted. It looked tiny, all the way at the far end of the hall, and the assembled wizards were all huddled together at one end. They could have spread out far enough to not hear each other and only used half of the table. Martin was never one for parties, but he knew there was a chance that by this time tomorrow he'd be sitting in the back of a squad car, hopefully wearing a bathrobe. So he was determined to enjoy this night. As they approached the table, all of the wizards stood and applauded. Jimmy floated out and met them well before they got to the table. Martin surreptitiously tapped his staff 3 times on the floor as Jimmy approached. "Martin, welcome," said Jimmy, putting a hand on Martin's back and leading him toward the head of the table. Martin could see that 2 seats had been saved for them. A large, ornate onyx seat with a high back at the head of the table, and an empty spot on the bench to the right of the chair. When Martin started for the bench, Jimmy stopped him. "Martin," he said, not unkindly, "what are you doing?" "Well, that chair's, you know, at the head of the table, and I just figured since you're the chairman..." Martin trailed off.
"Nonsense! Martin, this is your banquet! You're the guest of honor!"
Jimmy said, guiding Martin into the fancy stone chair.
"Tonight, you get to sit in my chair."
Martin settled into the seat. It was the most comfortable, ice-cold slab of stone he had ever sat on. He looked around for Philip and made eye contact with him as he settled into the only seat still available, on the bench at the far end of the group. Philip clearly seemed to find the seating arrangement funny, so Martin didn't worry about it. Gary and Jeff were at the far end of the group with Philip. They immediately fell into serious conversation. Every other person was a stranger, but they had certain things in common. They were all men between the ages of 20 and 40. Most had facial hair, some so thick and unkempt that Martin feared they were home to rodents, others so scraggly that they barely earned the name beard. Here was a group of guys that would look right at home at a table in the cafeteria of the Googleplex, the Microsoft Redmond campus, or a science fiction convention. But they were in medieval England, dressed as wizards, and they were all looking at Martin. Jimmy introduced Martin to the wizard seated to his left, an Asian man in his 30s, wearing a spectacular red silk robe and hat, both embroidered with dragons. His staff leaned against the table next to him. It was some sort of highly polished driftwood with a claw carved into its top as a figurehead. Jimmy said,
"This is Wing Po, mysterious sorcerer from the East."
Wing Po extended his hand and in a thick New Jersey accent said,
"Hiya, you can call me Eddie."
Martin shook his hand. A profoundly awkward silence descended on the table. Everyone was looking at Martin, and Martin was looking back at everyone.
"Hi, everyone,"
Martin said. Nobody said hi back, but there were nods of acknowledgement all around. Martin continued.
"Thanks for coming."
Everyone was offering encouraging looks except Philip, Gary, and Jeff, who were just enjoying the show. Jimmy put his hand on Martin's wrist and said,
"Martin, you don't have to say anything."
"Oh, good. Thank you,"
Martin replied.
"But you can if you want to," Jimmy said. "Go ahead."
Everybody seemed to lean in, expecting to hear something good, particularly Philip, Gary, and Jeff. Martin said.
"I, for one, am hungry. Let's eat."
The assembled wizards approved of this. Jimmy clapped his hands. Servers in gold uniforms, accented with contrasting, slightly shinier gold trim, brought out a variety of roasted animals, boiled vegetables, and breads that seemed to be made up entirely of crust. An empty earthenware mug was placed in front of each wizard. As all of the other servers hustled out of the hall, a single steward with a large jug entered and started to pour the contents of the jug into Martin's cup, but Jimmy stopped him.
"Steward, this is a solemn occasion," Jimmy said. "Leave us in peace and see that nobody enters this hall until we emerge. Go now. We will have no need of your intoxicating drink."
The steward bowed deeply and hastily, and then nearly ran out of the hall. When the door had shut with a thud that reverberated throughout the massive room, Jimmy removed his hat and reached inside, saying,
"We're more than capable of supplying our own."
He pulled out a bottle of scotch and sat it on the table with a satisfying clink. The wizard started removing their hats and producing their beverages of choice. Martin pulled out a bottle of Diet Dr. Pepper. Jimmy tilted his head and squinted at him.
"I'll save the booze for after I've demonstrated my salutation," Martin said.
Jimmy seemed to approve. After that, the assembled wizards did the most reassuring thing they could do. They ignored Martin and ate. There were only men at the table, as women tended to find the climate of medieval England a bit more favorable for wizards than it was for witches. Martin remembered that Philip told him the women who found the file tended to go to Atlantis, either right off the bat or immediately after training. Martin had asked if any of the men ever went to check it out.
"Go to see a society governed by women who choose to go somewhere we weren't? No, we've never sent anyone to go look around. We're afraid we might not like what we find."
The wizards all knew each other. They gathered regularly, but thanks to teleportation, they were able to live in small clusters spread all over Western Europe and into Russia. Only a few chose to live very far from any other wizards. Anybody who's attended a large family holiday meal would recognize the pattern of the conversation. There were small pockets of tentative conversation, followed by chewing noises. Then there was genuine, lively conversation about unimportant topics. Those conversations picked up steam as the eating wound down. Less successful conversations died off, killed by more successful conversations, and soon there was a nice mix of talking and laughter as the men at the table started to remember all the reasons that they liked each other. The key, any good host knew, was to intervene before everyone started remembering why they didn't like each other. Even his most virulent critic, Philip, would agree. Jimmy was a good host. Jimmy rose from his seat, which for Jimmy meant floating straight up into the air, gliding sideways so he was no longer over his chair, then stretching out to a standing position. Once all that was accomplished, he took Martin around the table, introducing him to everybody and making some small talk. Martin later reflected that 18 is just about the optimal number of new people to meet at one time, if your goal is to not remember anything specific about any of them. He had already met Eddie/Wing Po, who lived in London/Camelot with Jimmy/Merlin and was his best friend/assistant. The Paris contingent had the most elaborate robes and staffs. There were four of them, named Daniel, Stephen, Mitchell, and Greg. They were all Americans. They talked at great length about French girls in such a manner that it was clear they did not know what they were talking about. The guys from Norway, Magnus and Magnus, had little bits of fur on their robes as trim, which wasn't necessary, as the shell made sure they were never cold. They were from the late 90s, and had both chosen their names to honor the world's strongest man, Magnus Ver Magnusson. Their interests included Vikings, heavy metal, and fulfilling stereotypes. Martin suggested they should talk to Gary. But they knew Gary already, and derided him as being too glam. There was one guy named David who lived in Russia. Martin asked him why he chose Russia, and he replied, "Russian women." That was all he said, but he said it in a way that left Martin sure that David knew exactly what he was talking about. Jimmy and Martin had worked their way down the right side of the table, reaching the rest of the England contingent, Philip, Gary, and Jeff. Jimmy said,
"And I know you've already met Gary and Jeff."
"Yeah," Martin said while shaking hands.
"Still no Tyler?"
Gary shrugged.
"Dunno. He disappears from time to time, but this is the longest he's ever been gone."
Jeff added,
"Weird part is, the guy doesn't answer his hand. It's not like him.
Maybe spending some time up in the future. His plumbing may have finally given out.
Well, I'm very disappointed that he's not here, Jimmy said. I do prefer to have everybody attend these banquets.
And by prefer, he means demand, Philip said.
It makes it nicer for the new wizard, Jimmy continued.
Philip also continued.
And by new wizard, he means Jimmy's ego.
Jeff looked puzzled. It makes it nicer for the Jimmy's ego? He quoted.
Yes, Philip assured him. The Jimmy sometimes refers to himself in the third person and uses the definite article. That's just the Jimmy's way.
Jimmy said.
I do not.
Jimmy put his hand on Martin's shoulder and teleported the two of them to the other side of the table, rather than walking all the way down and around the empty two-thirds left at the end. They continued working their way up the table. Carl, Felix, and Theodore lived in various parts of Germany and seemed to communicate entirely through inside jokes. Fred and Louis lived in Spain.
Isn't that a little close to the Crusades?
Martin asked. Fred gave a knowing smile.
It's right in the middle of the Crusades.
It's where the action is,
Louis said. The two went on to describe the action as if it were a particularly exciting football game. Martin was relieved when Jimmy ushered him on to the next group. The last five wizards chose to live in Italy, specifically Tuscany, because why wouldn't they? They were Ross, Lenny, Ron, Sergio, and Kirk. It was clear immediately that Sergio and Kirk did most of the talking, and Sergio's part was largely urging Kirk to be quiet. It turned out Ron had attended the University of Washington and discovered the file only a couple of years before Martin. It was strange to think that he and Ron had probably passed each other more than once without taking any notice of each other, and now they were finally meeting hundreds of years in the past and on the other side of the globe. The introductions were over. The meal was eaten. The drinking had just started building momentum. It was time for the entertainment, and at a party thrown by Jimmy, that could only mean one thing.
Speech! Speech!
Eddie shouted, striking his knife against his earthenware mug with a dull clunking noise. Martin and Jimmy looked at each other, both seemingly caught off guard. Martin reluctantly started to stand. Jimmy put a hand on Martin's shoulder and pushed him back down into his chair as Jimmy rose to speak.
Friends,
Jimmy said. There was a cough from the far end of the table.
And Philip?
Thank you,
the distant voice said.
We are here,
Jimmy continued,
to welcome a new member into our family. Martin, a young man with tremendous potential, who was brought here as we all were by his abilities, his cunning, his willingness to do things others would not consider, and his desire to become something that others would not consider possible. Something more than what he was. A wizard. Now, he's here with us, and we call upon him to demonstrate the power he has earned by learning to not just use and understand computers, but by finding the file, having the grit to use the file, and by listening to his betters. Or in this case, the person his betters allowed to train him.
Jimmy paused while someone made a strangled choking noise at the far end of the table.
Now rise, Martin, and show us your salutation, for in the morning you face the trials, and then you will truly be a wizard.
Martin rose and started to thank Jimmy, but Jimmy, oblivious, cut him off.
Or we'll strip you naked, truss you up like a turkey, and send you back to your time, where a prison cell awaits.
Martin didn't thank Jimmy after all. He and Philip had discussed the purpose and theory of the salutation at length. Initially, Philip had described it as a display wizards put on to demonstrate their powers. It's one thing to tell the non-wizards that you have magical powers, but one often needed to do something ordinary mortals couldn't to seal the deal. The salutation also sent a message to other wizards. As it had evolved, every part of it had taken on new layers of meaning. What you said to trigger it. How elaborate it was, how much thought you put into transitions, what imagery you used, what impression you gave the witnesses, all spoke volumes about who you were and what you thought was impressive. Do you create fire or flowers? Unicorns or demons? Do you dissolve in an elaborate light show or just wink out like an old-timey camera trick? Do you use props and stagecraft or just say abracadabra?
Don't say abracadabra, Philip had told him. I'd rather you made the obvious joke than hear you say abracadabra.
Martin did not say abracadabra. Instead, he said, "For this, I'll need the assistant of the imp I've captured to do my bidding." With his left hand, he held his staff, with its silver and gray bust of El Santo. With his right, he reached into his pocket and produced the small carved box Philip had hastily given him as a gift. He had painted it with silver and gray highlights to match his robe and staff. He held the box in front of him and swung the hinged lid open with his finger. From most angles, the lid appeared to open on its own. As the lid opened, a flickering, uneven light came out of the box and washed Martin's face. Martin could see a smartphone wedged into the bottom of the box with some wooden shims to keep it from rattling around. Martin smiled and muttered into the box as if he were talking to a treasured pet.
"Wake up, imp. There's a good imp. I'll call you Tyrion. Yes, I will."
There were a few laughs, but Martin could tell they were laughing with him, not at him. Everything Martin had done so far was just preamble. Now it was time to get to the serious part. He said,
"Starigis Laceneo."
And immediately it looked as if Martin dove headfirst into the box. His head shrunk and disappeared into the box, followed by the rest of him until only his hands, still full-sized, remained at the ends of his stretched and contorted arms, which looped around and terminated into the box. Then Martin's arms and hands followed, dragging the base of the box with them. The box itself warped, twisted, and disappeared into itself, leaving only the ornately carved lid, which slammed shut, buckled, shrunk, and vanished. In the middle of the cavernous hall, 4 feet above the very spot where Martin had tapped his staff 3 times at the beginning of the party, a small light winked in and out of existence with a faint pop. When the light disappeared, the box was left in its place, hovering in midair. Its lid opened and a thick white smoke poured out and fell heavily to the floor. Instead of spreading when it reached the cold marble, it coalesced into a pillar that grew and thickened until it solidified in the form of Martin. Still holding his staff and peering into his box, to Martin's surprise, there was actually a smattering of applause. He smiled, then closed the imp box, placed it back in his pocket, planted his feet, and held his staff over his head with both hands, and looked at the floor. In a loud, deep voice, he said,
Neek, Chuck!
Silvery lines of pure energy traced the contours of Martin's form. The lines formed a pattern similar to the mortar in a brick wall. When the line pattern had covered him, the contours of Martin's body warped and flattened until he appeared to be a brick sculpture of Martin. But instead of bricks, he was made of copies of his imp box. For a moment, all was silent. Then Martin exploded. There was no fire, no smoke, not even any noise to speak of, just boxes flying and tumbling outward and then orbiting each other. They formed a 30-foot sphere of swirling, multiplying boxes. They spun chaotically for 2 revolutions, then reassembled into another statue of Martin, 3 stories tall. Because the boxes were still the same size, this statue was more recognizably human-shaped than the one before. The boxes were not touching each other, but were floating in a 3-dimensional pattern. For just an instant, when the statue stood still, the wizards could see Martin, suspended inside the statue's massive torso. It silently towered over the wizards as they sat, gaping in their seats. The huge staff it held level above its head was also constructed of imp boxes. The head of Santo looked large enough that a grown man could hide in it. Another brief round of applause started, but stopped dead when the statue raised its head. With a strange combination of ponderousness and speed, the statue's left hand pushed the staff, which spun like a helicopter blade, pivoting on the blindingly fast brick fingers of the statue's right hand. The hall filled with a deafening roar of wind until the statue's right arm came down to the statue's side, stopping the staff's spinning and slamming its base into the floor with a sound like a sonic boom. The statue looked straight ahead and let go of the staff, which stood balanced for a moment, then it collapsed into a pile of boxes, which spread into a lumpy rectangle at the statue of Martin's feet. The rectangle sharpened and solidified into the unmistakable shape of an immense sheet of corrugated cardboard and a massive dual-cassette boombox with four huge speakers. The statue looked down at the table of speechless wizards and jerked its chin upward sharply as if to say, "What's up?" The giant statue bent sideways at the waist. With a massive finger, it hit a button on the top of the boombox. The great hall was filled with the familiar hiss of a cassette player until the inevitable finally happened. The boombox played Herbie Hancock's Rocket. As loud as the giant boombox was, it was nearly drowned out by cheering and laughing as the statue started to do the robot. Once it had demonstrated its mastery of robotics, the statue dove forward, did a serviceable version of the worm, then hoisted itself into a headstand and swung its legs around wildly for a moment before doing a head spin. The head spin transitioned seamlessly into a backspin, which ended with the statue lying on its side on the cardboard. It was facing the wizards, its head supported by its arm, and its upper leg bent at the knee in a posture of simulated relaxation. With its free arm, the robot formed a gun with its thumb and forefinger, which it aimed at the table of wizards. As Herbie Hancock hit a large downbeat on the drums, the statue shot the finger gun, and in an instant, the statue, the boombox, and the cardboard all collapsed into splinters that fell to the ground and disappeared. All of the wizards were applauding and cheering, except one. The cheering only got louder when they realized that the wizard who wasn't applauding was Martin, who had been standing next to Jimmy since the moment the statue started dancing. The rest of the night was a blur of drinking and laughing. The only serious moment occurred when Jimmy pulled him aside and asked him about his plans.
"I haven't made any beyond trying to pass the trials tomorrow," Martin said.
"Look, I know you and Philip are friends," Jimmy said. "And I know that Philip and I aren't, but if you don't have anything to do in Lead Church, I hope you'll consider coming here to Camelot. I could use a man like you."
Martin looked at Jimmy, then looked around at the opulent palace Jimmy had essentially created through sheer force of will.
"What on earth would you possibly need me for, Jimmy?"
Jimmy patted him on the back.
"In theory, no one wizard is more powerful than any other. But you'll learn that just because the shell gives everyone else the same powers you have, doesn't mean that they can do the same things you can do. You have something very rare, Martin. Showmanship. You know what most of these guys' salutations are? They fly and they glow and they shoot energy beams. If I'm lucky, they swing their staff around a bit while they do it."
Martin remembered Philip's display the night they met. Jimmy had just described it pretty well.
"What you did tonight was the first really original thing I've seen in a very long time. None of these guys could have done it. They don't have flair like you do."
"Gary has flair," Martin said.
"Yes," Jimmy admitted, "but he has no taste. He's all hellfire and bat wings. It's impressive, but nothing I can use." "I can use you, Martin. Think about it. You don't have to decide tonight, but when you get bored in Lead Church, and you will, you can always come here and help me make the world better."
Sometime around 1:30 in the morning, Martin learned the best thing about wizard parties, which is that because wizards can teleport, they can sleep in their own beds no matter how drunk they get or how far away the party was. Unfortunately, they still were susceptible to hangovers. And Martin woke up with the worst one of his life. The swaying of his hammock made him feel vaguely ill. The light coming in the windows made his brain feel as if it was on fire. The slightest noise was agony. For a moment, while he was still only half awake, he thought he heard a very distant, hollow noise that sounded almost like growling, which was a new one, but he figured it was the blood rushing through the veins in his ears. He carefully dismounted his hammock. He groaned lightly as his feet took over the task of supporting his weight. The groan was barely a whisper, but it was enough to cause Philip to gasp,
"Keep down the racket!"
Then Philip winced at the toll his own voice had taken on his head. Martin attempted to say he was sorry silently by squinting at Philip and waving his arms vaguely, and then he shuffled into the bathroom to go deface Jimmy's statue. Over the next hour, the two men moped and groaned their way back into the world of the living. The quality of life in medieval England had improved drastically since Martin learned to pull black coffee, real food, and over-the-counter pain medications out of his hat. Of course, all of the food items he could access were gifted to him by Philip. He wouldn't be able to set up macros to retrieve his own favorite items until he had unlimited shell access and the ability to come and go to the future without the imminent threat of arrest. He'd figure out how to deal with the feds later. Today, his only priority was to pass the trials. He'd have felt a lot better if he knew what the trials were, but nobody had been willing to tell him anything. Martin spent the morning going over vocab, quizzing himself on technique, and generally making himself more nervous. Philip spent the morning reading a dog-eared paperback of Ender's Game that he'd borrowed from Jeff. After a couple of hours of this, Philip's hut was filled with a warbling chime sound that Martin had anticipated and dreaded in equal measure. Philip smiled at Martin and said,
"Well, Martin, that's the call. You ready?"
"I really don't think so," Martin answered.
"Good."
Philip raised his right arm and held his hand as if he were palming a softball. The chiming sound died, and a glowing blue image of a calligraphic letter M appeared in Philip's hand.
"The hour is nigh,"
Jimmy's voice bellowed.
"Is the initiate ready to face the trials?"
"Yep,"
Philip said with aggressive informality.
"Excellent! Bring him forth to the great hall of the Castle Camelot to be tested and judged."
"Uh-huh.
Will do,"
Philip replied. The uppercase M in Philip's hand hovered there silently for a long moment, then disappeared.
"Does he do everything in the Great Hall?" Martin asked.
"Wouldn't you?"
Philip stood up, smoothing out his robe.
"Well," he said, "I guess it's about that time. Do you have to use the bathroom before we go?"
"No," Martin said. "You?"
"No," Philip said. "Let's just get this done."
Martin hesitated.
Phil, I just want to say, no matter how this ends up, I really appreciate everything you've done for me."
Philip put a comforting hand on Martin's shoulder.
"You're welcome, Martin. And don't worry, you're going to do fine."
Martin smirked.
"I know, because if I don't, you'll send me to prison naked."
Philip looked wounded.
"I wasn't going to say that, Marty."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"But it's true. We'll totally do that to you. Transporto rondo tableau!"
In an instant, they were standing in the center of the black granite disc that marked the center of the great hall of the Castle Camelot. The disc was raised as it was when being used as the round table, but the chairs remained recessed into the floor, giving the overall effect that Martin and Philip were standing on a raised pedestal for examination. The hall was dim, despite the massive windows that lined its sides. Martin saw that there were huge curtains drawn over the windows, blocking most of the light. All of the wizards he had met, dined with, and entertained, with his avatars breakdancing the night before, were there, arranged in a curved row, facing the platform where he and Philip stood. As his eyes adjusted, Martin could see that one of the wizards on the end seemed to be holding some rope. At the middle of the line, one wizard stood taller than the rest because he was hovering 5 inches above the floor.
"Who comes to face the trials?"
the hovering wizard asked.
"With all due respect," Philip said, "you know exactly who it is, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't waste his time with your idiocy, Jimmy."
"That wasn't very respectful," Jimmy said.
"No, but it's all the respect you're due. Now get on with it."
Martin recognized Jeff and Gary's laughs coming from the end of the line of wizards. Jimmy took a moment to compose himself, then continued.
"Are his skills adequate to the challenges that await him?"
You know they are, or I wouldn't have said he was ready, would I?
Philip answered.
All right, then. Philip, you've done your duty. Leave your apprentice to his fate.
Philip clambered down off of the platform and walked slowly to the end of the shadowy line of wizards. As he reached his spot, he said,
Hello, Gary, Jeff. You brought the extra scratchy rope, I see.
Muffled laughs and shushing followed.
Martin, do you feel ready to leave your life as an apprentice behind and take on the powers and responsibilities of a wizard?
Martin gave Jimmy a look that he hoped read as determination and said,
Yes.
A long moment passed. Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. If someone had told Martin that the birds outside had stopped flying in midair, he would not have doubted it. Finally, Jimmy said,
Okay.
Martin looked at all of the other wizards. They all looked at him. He looked back to Jimmy and said,
Good.
Jimmy replied,
Yes, good.
Martin looked at Philip, who held up his hands and mouthed the word, What?
They're messing with me, Martin thought. They're trying to put me off balance. Then when I'm vulnerable, the trials will begin.
He bent his knees, transferring his weight to the balls of his feet. He hunched his shoulders slightly, put his empty left hand out in front of him for balance, and held his staff slightly behind so he could whip it forward with force if need be. For another long moment, all was silent, and Martin was at the center of the universe, a coiled spring, ready for whatever happened next. Eventually, Martin realized that nothing was going to happen. He stood up straight again and asked,
Okay, what's going on?
When the wizards were done laughing, Jimmy explained,
It's over, Martin. You're in.
What? But the trials
were last night,
Jimmy said.
If you must call them that. Look, Martin, the point of the trials is to make sure that you know what you're doing and that you can be trusted. Philip has lived with you and trained you, and he says you're okay. We all met you last night and you didn't set off anybody's warning bells, so you're in.
Martin sat down on the edge of the round table. He didn't know if he was more relieved or angry.
So it was all a lie?
No, Philip said as he walked to where Martin was sitting. It wasn't all a lie. It was mostly a lie. In a sense, the trials began when you and I met, and the final test was your macro last night. You got off to a rocky start, but you paid attention, you learned, and you took the whole thing seriously.
What if I hadn't? Martin asked. It's happened before. Philip told me about a trainee who failed a few years ago.
Mitchell, one of the three wizards from Paris, spoke up.
Yeah, I had an apprentice who seemed all right at first. Then I caught him practicing his powers on animals. Nasty business.
What did you do?
I called Jimmy,
Mitchell said,
and told him about it. He had me tell the guy that he was ready for the trials. We had a dinner just like last night, and he showed us his macro, which I'm not going to describe to you because there are some things you can't unhear. It's bad enough we had to see it. Ugh. Anyway, after that, we were unanimous that he had to go. The next morning, we told him he'd failed, and we used the shell to make it so that no integrated circuit would function within 10 feet of him.
That's how you keep him from using the file, Martin said. I'd wondered about that.
Yeah, unless he figures out how to access the file from an abacus, the world is safe. Then we send him back to his time.
Yeah, Martin said, waving his hand. Hogtied and naked so the police would get him. Are you sure the police were looking for him?
Oh, yeah,
Mitchell said.
No question. The fact is, the police are looking for almost all of us.
Many heads nodded. Gary said,
It turns out that bank fraud is surprisingly hard to get away with, even if you create the money out of thin air.
Jimmy nodded.
Not surprisingly, really. At the end of the day, all a bank really does is track money. It makes sense that they'd be pretty good at it.
By this time, all of the wizards had walked over near where Martin was sitting. Fun is fun, but they knew they had put Martin through the ringer, and they wanted to make sure he was all right. Partly because they'd all been there themselves, and partly because few things are more dangerous than a wizard bent on revenge.
So, Marty, Philip said, you haven't said yet if you'll join us.
Martin shook his head.
Are you kidding? Philip, how can you ask me that? Of course I'm going to join you, even if there wasn't unimaginable power in it for me. And even if the feds weren't waiting in my time to take me to jail, I'd stick around just to help do this to the next sap to come along.
That was when everyone knew that Martin was truly one of them. There were many handshakes and backslaps. Jimmy congratulated Martin, then excused himself and his assistant, Eddie, saying they had pressing business elsewhere. Gary made a pizza run, and the remaining wizards generally had a pleasant afternoon. They all found Martin to be a little quicker to laugh now that the pressure was off. Slowly, wizards started making their excuses and going back to their homes. Finally, it was just Martin, Philip, Gary, and Jeff left to clean up.
I wish Tyler were here, Gary said.
He'd have enjoyed this, Philip agreed.
That, and he has all those paper towels in his apartment,
Gary said while attempting to scrape some melted cheese off of the granite table with the edge of a cardboard pizza box, leaving a smear of oil behind.
You could go to your time and get a roll, Jeff said.
Yes, but we both know that's not going to happen,
Gary said. He piled all of the pizza boxes on the stone floor, aimed his staff at them, and said,
Flammo, sir.
There was an intense gout of blue flames. The pizza boxes completely burned away in less than a second. With nothing left to feed them, the flames took on the shapes of demons and rose to the ceiling and dissipated. For just a moment, Martin could see that the spaces between the flames took the shape of a man waving his arms frantically as if in agony. When the flames were gone, Martin said,
That was a touch overdramatic.
Jeff smiled.
Like you should talk.
Jeff and Gary said goodbye and disappeared into thin air.
How do you think he made the areas between the flames look like a person?
Martin asked. Philip said.
I didn't even notice that.
There was nothing left for Martin and Philip to do but go home themselves. Home meaning Philip's home, which became all too obvious to Martin quite quickly. They rematerialized in Philip's hut, and Philip rubbed his hands together and said,
I expect you'll be anxious to get out on your own.
Martin didn't know how to react.
Philip, I hope I haven't done something to make you think I'm anxious to leave.
Oh, Marty,
Philip said in a chummy sort of way.
I didn't say think. I said expect. There's a difference. So, where will you go?
I guess I'll get a place of my own,
Martin sputtered.
Splendid idea! When?
I don't know, tomorrow morning?
Philip shook his head and put an arm around Martin's shoulders. He said,
Martin, don't stay here for me.
Martin clearly heard a comma that wasn't stated, but was there nonetheless. Martin, don't stay here. For me. Martin suddenly realized that Philip had shared his entire existence with Martin, and now he wanted it to himself again. Martin couldn't blame him.
It's a bit late to try to find a shack of my own, Martin said. But I bet Pete has a room at the Rotted Stump he'd rent me until I find a place.
I bet he does. You might even be able to pay him in cling film. I'll tell you what, you go get a room, and then I'll help you move your things.
All I have is my laptop.
I'll help you move your thing.
Martin had set a teleportation waypoint for the Rotted Stump. He suspected Pete, Gert, and the others would be pleasant company if he stopped trying to impress them all the time, a quality he now realized that they shared with pretty much all of humanity. He uttered some Esperanto and appeared outside the Rotted Stump. A friendly conversation and a small transaction later, he was the temporary owner of a room with a bed in it. When he reappeared at the hut, Philip was waiting. Martin grabbed his laptop. Philip handed him his bundle of street clothes, wrapped in his old Hogwarts robe. Martin had nearly forgotten them, but realized immediately that he'd want them if he ever went back to his own time. Neither of them were particularly emotional guys, so their goodbye couldn't help but be awkward. A poorly worded, thank you, was followed by an inelegant,
you're welcome,
and punctuated with a stiff, uncertain hug. When the hug finally ended, Philip said,
I'm happy to have you as a friend, Martin, and even happier to lose you as a roommate.
What would have been a cutting remark just 15 minutes before made them both laugh now. Then Martin teleported to his room on the second floor of the Rotted Stump, and he was on his own. That night, Martin lay in bed and considered his next move. He could do anything he wanted. He just had to figure out what he wanted. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life in the long term, but that could wait. Near term was all he needed to worry about tonight. The noise from the tavern coming up through the floorboards made it clear that his first order of business would be getting a place of his own. His first impulse was to stay in Ledchurch. All of his friends were here, and there was close proximity to Gwen. Then again, Ledchurch was a pretty small place, and as he said, all of his friends were here. It was a pretty high wizard saturation for such a small town. Then it struck him that he didn't actually know where Gary's cave was. He'd assumed it was close, but he never asked. For all he knew, the cave was clear up in Scotland. For the first time, it really struck home with Martin that, thanks to teleportation, the entire world was really just down the hall. He could literally set up shop anywhere, and it would make no difference. Martin thought about all he knew of this version of medieval England, and realized that the most interesting place he knew of was Camelot. Martin was a city boy, and Camelot was where the action was. He didn't have to worry about Jimmy getting angry because Martin was moving in on his turf because Jimmy had invited him. He didn't know how Philip would react, but it wasn't like he was siding with Jimmy. He was just moving to the capital to see things for himself. The next morning, Martin used the hand phone spell to call Jimmy. He told the glowing M in his palm that he was going to stay in Camelot for a while. It took some effort not to call it London, to see if he liked it. Jimmy was delighted, and said that he'd have Eddie find a couple of prospective places to look at. The following day, Eddie had three places to show Martin. Eddie explained the various features of the buildings, resplendent in his red silk robe with gold embroidered dragons, as he showed the sizes of the rooms and the proximity to various shops and inns. Martin amused himself with the notion that it was like having Ming the Merciless as a realtor. He mentioned this to Eddie. Eddie laughed, then pointed out in his thick New Jersey accent that Martin was wearing a silver robe and carrying a stick with a luchador head on it. Martin thought, "It's amazing how quickly we get used to the weirdness when it's our own weirdness." He settled on a building in a bustling area on the east side of town. It had been used mainly for storage. It had a smallish room facing the street, and then a very large room with a high ceiling in the back. Eddie had suggested it because it would give Martin room to work on large-scale macros. And Martin couldn't help but agree. It didn't take Martin long to pull enough gold from his hat to buy the place outright. After Eddie left, Martin looked at his new home and realized that he had no furniture of any kind. He made a quick list of all the stuff he'd had in his old apartment, then he asked himself how much of it he'd really needed. The answer was, not much of it. He decided that the first things he needed were a table, a chair, a bed, and some bedding. Chairs and tables could be procured here in Camelot, but the comfort level of the standard-issue straw and scratchy blanket bed he'd used at the Rotted Stump had not impressed him, and he had no intention of spending the rest of his life sleeping in a hammock. In the Banks' living room, chaos reigned. Walter and Margarita Banks could tell from the cacophony of sirens, pounding noises, and yelled threats that their quiet suburban front yard was crawling with law enforcement officers, many of whom would soon be coming in. Their youngest son, Martin, had burst in unannounced and sprinted into his old bedroom, emerging several times in quick succession to model his old Halloween costume, mutter about Draco Malfoy, demand saran wrap, and ask geography questions. Then he demanded a package that he said he'd ordered but seemed surprised to see. Now he was back in his room. The pounding at the door was getting louder. Through the sirens, they could hear a man's voice yelling,
"We are federal agents! We are pursuing a suspect, and we saw him enter these premises! Open this door immediately or we will break it down!"
"One moment, I'm coming!"
Walter yelled. He and his wife, Margarita, exchanged bewildered looks, and Walter started toward the door.
"No, Dad, stop!"
Margarita and Walter looked down the hall. Martin had come out of his room again. He was standing in the hall wearing a silver sequined bathrobe and a pointy hat. He was carrying a long pole with his old souvenir bust of what Margarita had always called
"the stupid wrestler"
perched on its tip.
"Martin, baby, what's going on?"
Margarita asked.
"What have you done?"
"Nothing,"
Martin said as he lurched three steps down the hall and threw open the door to the linen closet.
"I haven't done anything.
he continued as he grabbed a small stack of sheets and pillowcases.
I especially haven't done any of the things those men are going to tell you I did.
Martin yanked a blanket down from the top shelf, clamped his staff against his body with his left arm, slammed the closet door shut with his foot, and quickly went back to his bedroom, shouting,
Thanks for everything! See you later! Dad, you can open the door now!
The bedroom door slammed shut behind him. Martin rematerialized in his new home, holding a pile of laundry in one hand and his smartphone in the other. He hastily threw the laundry down on the pile of his old street clothes, hoping that would keep them relatively dirt-free. He put down his staff, took a breath, then touched the screen of his phone with his thumb and disappeared again. A moment later, he reappeared, bear-hugging the mattress from his childhood bed, which was rolled up like a giant burrito. It still had all of its bedding attached, as if he had simply pushed the fully made mattress over on itself, stood it on end, threw his arms around it, and hastily teleported out of there, which is exactly what he had done. He let go of the mattress. It unfolded and fell limply to the floor, creating a low whoomp noise and a noticeable cloud of dust. Martin said,
I'm home.